I think that means it's time. The lights going off means it's time to start. This is a very encouraging congregation. They encouraged us to use PowerPoint. They encouraged us to wear name tags. Very encouraging. We were talking about the latter part of the seventh chapter of the book of Revelation. And the last thing I think I want to say about that is that they were given white robes in verse 9. The great multitude were given white robes, and down a little bit later in verse 14, they have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Back in chapter 6, the martyrs were given white robes. Here, these are given white robes. They credit their salvation to God and to the Lamb. White had been their color in this world, and white will be their color in the next world. The saints of God are continually passing away into the unseen world, taking their place among the spirits of just men made perfect. Verse 14, these came safely through all the trials of the saints, as God looks at it. They didn't recant, they were faithful unto death, so even if they were killed for their faith, as God sees them, they came safely through. Sometimes we look at physical death differently than the way God does. Let those who suffer for the faith take courage from this great promise. The fact that white results from washing in the red blood is enough to show the figurative nature of the language here. This cannot be literal. Verse 17 says, "The Lamb is the shepherd." Now this has all been under the sixth seal. The winds of destruction have been held back. They're wanting to blow. Both scenes in chapter 7 are to encourage the faithful. They're about to experience the judgment forecast in the following chapters. So let's go on to chapter 8. And even though it takes a little time, I probably ought to read this chapter. "When he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. And I saw the seven angels which stood before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. And another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer. And there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. And the angel took the censer and filled it with the fire of the altar and cast it into the earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. And the seven angels which had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood. And they were cast upon the earth. And the third part of the trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. And the second angel sounded, and as it were a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea. And the third part of the sea became blood, and the third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and the third part of the ships were destroyed. And the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp. And it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood. And the third part of the waters became wormwood. And many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. And the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars. So as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for the third part of it, and the night likewise. And behold, I heard an eagle flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound." We have come to the seventh seal, and this is the last seal on a book of seven seals. Seven was the number for completion, maturity, perfection, or wholeness. Three is the number of God, four is the number of the earth, and added together they make seven, God's dealings with the world. As far as any creature knew, this seal would reveal everything that was left to be revealed. The opening of the seventh seal completes the unsealing of the seven-sealed scroll. This is an element of the designed ambiguity of the book of Revelation, which cloaks the chronology in mystery until after the fulfillment of the forecast events. John saw seven trumpets signaling successive judgments wherein the seventh seal is developed. There was silence in contrast to the loud song of praise in chapter 7. As in the book All Quiet on the Western Front, there was a dramatic pause, a hushed calm before the storm, of about a half an hour, an indefinite and brief delay, so the Christian faith could become a solid force in the Roman Empire. The distinction between sealed and unsealed is recognized by God all through the trumpet judgments. Four destructive angels are holding back or restraining four destroying winds, and all of heaven is breathlessly awaiting the development. For the first time, a major junction point has come in the predicted judgments. When these winds blow, the city of Rome will be obliterated as a world power. In the north, there are gathering forces. Horde after horde of reckless, lawless barbarians have become Arian believers in Christ. We're about to see the fall of a third part of the Roman Empire, the Western Empire. Now, the Jews believed that there are seven archangels, and they had them all named, although the names vary according to the sources. Names like Uriel, Raphael, Raguel, Michael, Sarachiel, Gabriel, Remiel. That particular list is found in 1 Enoch chapter 20, but there are other lists, other places. You're aware that the Bible only speaks of one archangel and calls him Michael. The only other angel named in the Bible is Gabriel, but he's never called an archangel. The seventh seal introduces the second major series of prophecies, the trumpets. The trumpets were used to make public announcements and to sound the charge of armies. The trumpets, like the seals before them, give chronological structure to the elements of the prophecy. The trumpets are about to signal coming judgments from which the saints are not going to be spared. In the third and fourth verses, we see here that the prayers of God's people keep on ascending no matter what. Even though the apostatizing church at this time was praying to saints and martyrs, the prayers of God's people, His true people, kept ascending. And there were no new ways of propitiating God like the apostate church was trying to come up with. Under the apostate time, there was a rapid relapse under Christian names and under Christian profession into a Christ-forsaking idolatry. Enthusiasm for the martyrs, which I can easily understand. Someone passes on and we tend to idealize them, talk about how wonderful they were. But that kind of enthusiasm for the martyrs easily passed into superstition. It came to be that prayer seemed never so efficacious as when offered at the tomb of some saint. Dead saints were connected with certain localities. Priests began to be called mediators, hence arose a superstitious awe of the clerical body, as dispensers of both the favor and the wrath of heaven. We see Christ then superseded as the one mediator. There was more and more of a barrier imposed between Christ and each human soul. The highest and most influential of the bishops in these churches all erred on this issue. Gibbon said, "If at the beginning of the 5th century, Tertullian or Lactantius," and these were people from earlier times, "if they had been suddenly raised from the dead, they would have gazed with astonishment and indignation on the profane spectacle which had succeeded to the pure and spiritual worship of a Christian congregation. As soon as the doors of the church were thrown open, they must have been offended by the smoke of incense. Prayers were directed to the bones, the blood, or the ashes of the saint. The ignorant masses would more cheerfully renounce the superstitions of paganism if they found some resemblance in the bosom of Christianity. The religion of Constantine achieved in less than a century the conquest of the Roman Empire, but the victors themselves were subdued by the arts of their vanquished rivals." Now, Gibbon uses these long elliptical sentences and lots of pretty language, but what he's saying there is that when Christianity conquered paganism, paganism sort of turned around and conquered Christianity, pure Christianity too. In the 10th chapter of the book of Ezekiel, we saw that an angel took coals and scattered them over the city of Jerusalem because God was going to make a sacrifice of Jerusalem. And now, here in Revelation 8, he's going to make a sacrifice of Rome. This is the fire of divine judgment, indicated by the thunder and lightning and earthquake. The lightnings and thunders and voices and earthquakes form the close of the introduction to the seventh seal, as they do likewise to the seventh trumpet in chapter 11, verse 19, and the seventh bowl in chapter 16, verse 18. The trumpet was used as a signaling instrument. The trumpet sounded loudly when the law was given at Sinai. In Israel, the priests blew trumpets to call worshipers to the festivals. The Battle of Jericho was commemorated annually at the Feast of Tabernacles by the blowing of trumpets. Commanders used trumpets to signal troops in warfare. This practice prevailed in the Roman armies as well when the book of Revelation was written. The last trump of God will sound at the second coming of Christ to signal the resurrection. The trumpet is a symbol of the intervention of God in history. Here the trumpets signal events that are future to John, which the Lord views as divine judgments leading inexorably on toward the time of the end. The three major series indicated by the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls symbolically forecast three successive eras. We have seen the fall of paganism in the seals, and now we come to the first four trumpets, which are a unit. The trumpets, like the seals, in a lesser degree the bowls, reflect the stylistic style of 4, 2, and 1, that formula. These first four are tersely presented. The fifth and sixth have a more extended content, and then the seventh, after interludes, is both terse and cumulative, apparently introducing what follows after the series for the rest of the book. This suggests corresponding degrees of emphasis and maybe extended amounts of time in the events predicted. In both this section and in the section of the bowls, we see some Exodus language being used in describing the phenomena of the 10 plagues as a reaffirmation of the divine principles that are implicit in all of these events. The first four trumpets, metaphorically, target the earth and the sea and the rivers and springs and the sun, moon, and stars. So we should expect to see human armies advancing over land, fighting on the sea, and advancing by means of the great rivers. Great rivers were, until modern times, the freeways. They were the freeways of the ancient world. Before you had, even if you had roads in the ancient world, you couldn't move very quickly or effortlessly along them like you could a river. At least if you were going the right direction on the river, you could move effortlessly along. So we say, where are you from 235? Where are you from I-80? They said, where are you from the Danube? Where are you from the Po? The rivers were the points of reference, and that's why that's the way they're used in the book of Revelation. The sun suggests the highest ruling power. Hail is used in the Old Testament as evidence of divine punishment. Hailstorms usually came from the north. Hail prefigures destruction by northern armies executing judgment. If we wanted to take the time, we could go to Isaiah 28 and see that. The idea of being mixed with blood speaks of the terror of war. The earth here, as in Luke 2:1, refers to the Roman world. Let me nail that down with just a couple of references from secular authors. First of all, Dionysius of Halicarnassus wrote, quote, "The Republic of the Romans rules both the entire earth and the entire sea." This is the way that the world was thought of. Ovid the poet wrote, "The dimensions of the city of Rome and the dimension of the city of Rome and that of the earth is the same." So the world was the Roman Empire as viewed and as spoken by the people of that time. One third of the grass or the earth and the trees and the rivers and the sun, moon, and stars refers to part of the empire. Not the whole empire, but a third of the empire. A third part is one of the three divisions of the empire, namely the Western Empire, including Britain, Gaul, Spain, Italy, western part of the north coast of Africa. Green foliage was associated with beauty and well-being in the Mediterranean lands. We see the specific wasting of it under the first trumpet and the specific preservation of it later under the fifth trumpet by the locust. The mixture, I should mention, of literal with figurative language is essential to the nature of symbolism. And this is a point that's often raised as a point of confusion, if not contention. But I think it would be virtually impossible to take it all literally or all symbolically. Contact with reality would be completely lost. And in the prophetic language of the Bible, we have literal and figurative language mixed just so you can have a point of reference. The literal is for a point of reference so that it's not just out there in la-la land somewhere. Let me give you a couple of examples of this because this point is often raised. In Genesis 37, verse 9, Joseph is telling about one of his dreams. He says, the sun and moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. Made obeisance to me. He doesn't say they made obeisance to another star. They made obeisance to me. So Joseph is literal, and the sun, moon, and stars are figurative. But Joseph anchors the symbolism so that it can be understood. And we have a lot of occasions of this. I've listed just a few of them here. In the 80th Psalm, there's a mention of a vine out of Egypt. Egypt is literal. The vine is obviously figurative. Jeremiah 1:13, the seething pot from the north. North is literal. The seething pot is figurative. Jeremiah 3:6 talks about high mountains and green trees and playing the harlot. And that some of that is literal and some of it is not. Ezekiel 27, that talks about Tyre. Ezekiel 32, talking about the king of Egypt. We have the same kind of mixture of literal and figurative language. So we ought not to be put off by this or surprised by it. The barbarian invasions of the Roman Empire fulfilled the first four trumpet prophecies. These wars directly followed the era of the sixth seal, which closes with the death of Theodosius, which I think we may have talked about the other day. He was one of the very most prominent emperors. He solidified what Constantine had begun, probably the most prominent emperor between Constantine and Charlemagne. But he died on January the 17th, 395, and this was the barrier then taken away. Theodosius had been holding back the barbarians, and after he died, then they begin preparing to come in and to take over Rome if they possibly can. His death removed the restraint from the tempests of the barbarians. Gibbon said, quote, before the winter ended, the Gothic nations were in arms. That is the winter of his death. So the sequence of the four trumpets corresponds to the four major barbarian invasions that are cited by the historians of this period. The first trumpet is the Gothic invasion by Alaric and the Goths in 410 AD. Alaric and the Goths were Arians. They believed that Jesus Christ was a created being, but they did consider themselves Christians. They carried out the first major assault by a barbarian power against the Roman Empire. Alaric had begun his military career as a mercenary in the Roman army. He was right there. He became an officer, and in 398 he became a general in charge of eastern Illyricum. But he took advantage of the political instability after the death of Theodosius, and he marched his destroying army through Yugoslavia, Macedonia, and Greece. Alaric defied Rome by declaring himself the king of the Goths. And I guess I'll refrain myself from reading a citation from Gibbon here. I understand that there's a lot from Gibbon that helps us to flesh out this, but I'll wait to read in just a minute. Countries that were blooming like gardens were turned into treeless deserts. We're talking about the trees here under this first trumpet, and they were taken away. From 408 to 410, Alaric wasted Italy and laid siege to Rome three times. The first siege of Rome was in 408, and he was bought off by a ransom. The second siege was in 409. I will read you maybe a little bit about that. In 409, this is Gibbon, volume 2, 152. Talking about Rome, that unfortunate city gradually experienced the distress of scarcity. This is during the second siege in 409. That unfortunate city gradually experienced the distress of scarcity and at length the horrid calamities of famine. The daily allowance of 3 pounds of bread was reduced to one half, to one third, to nothing. And then later on he goes on and talks about the extent of the famine and what it came to in the end. A dark suspicion was entertained that some desperate wretches fed on the bodies of their fellow creatures which they had secretly murdered. And even mothers, such was the horrid conflict of the two most powerful instincts implanted by nature in the human breast, even mothers are said to have tasted the flesh of their slaughtered infants. Many thousands of the inhabitants of Rome expired in their houses or in the streets for want of sustenance. And as the public sepulchres without the wall were in the power of the enemy, the stench which arose from so many putrid and unburied carcasses infected the air, and the miseries of famine were succeeded and aggravated by the contagion of a pestilential disease. Quite similar to what I think it was Wade talking about yesterday in 2 Kings chapter 6 about the famines in Jerusalem. People get to the place where this seems the most reasonable alternative to eat the bodies of the people around you and even help them along toward death if it will help you to get satisfaction for your hunger. So this was the situation in the siege of 409. And then finally came the final siege in 410. And after 800 years without being sacked, because the city of Rome was sacked by the Gauls in 390 B.C., and this is 410 A.D. we're talking about. After 800 years without being sacked, and by the way, any records of Rome before 390 B.C. are suspect because all the records were burnt by the Gauls at that time. After 800 years without being sacked in 410 A.D., well, let me read it to you from Gibbon, this time from the same book, page 4 to page 163. The king of the Goths, who no longer dissembled his appetite for plunder and revenge, appeared in arms under the walls of the capital, and the trembling Senate, without any hopes of relief, prepared by a desperate resistance to delay the ruin of their country. But they were unable to guard against the secret conspiracy of their slaves and domestics, who either from birth or interest were attached to the cause of the enemy. At the hour of midnight, the Salarian gate was silently opened, and the inhabitants were awakened by the tremendous sound of the Goths. Gothic trumpet. Did you hear that agnostic historian talk about the Gothic trumpet? That's the first trumpet here in chapter 8. 1163 years after the foundation of Rome, the imperial city, which had subdued and civilized so considerable a part of mankind, was delivered to the licentious fury of the tribes of Germany and Scythia. That's the first trumpet. It's an amazing thing to think about. This barbarian army was given free rein for 3 days to pillage, rape, and destroy with unimaginable terror. Gibbon said, blood and conflagration and the burning of trees and herbage marked their path. It was a scorched earth policy. Will Durant, in volume 4 of his 11-volume Story of Civilization, says on page 36 of volume 4, which is the Age of Faith, and this is the same account, but with a little bit of different detail. A slave opened the gates. The Goths poured in. And for the first time in 800 years, the great city was taken by an enemy. For 3 days, Rome was subjected to discriminate pillage that left the churches of St. Peter and St. Paul untouched and spared the refugees who sought sanctuary in them. But the Huns and slaves and the army of 40,000 men could not be controlled. Hundreds of rich men were slaughtered, their women raped and killed. It was found almost impossible to bury all the corpses that littered the streets. Thousands of prisoners were taken among them. I'll move on down here. The works of art were melted down for their precious metals they contained. Many masterpieces of sculpture and pottery were joyously destroyed by former slaves who could not forgive the poverty and toil that had generated this beauty and wealth. Alaric restored discipline and led his troops southward to conquer Sicily, but in the same year he was stricken with fever and died. So many times the men who are fulfilling these prophecies, once they've fulfilled their part of it, they're dead. It's like their purpose is over, so they're gone, passed from the scene. And I mention that because I think as long as you're still here, your purpose is not over. Sometimes people wonder what their purpose is. Oh, I'm laying in bed, I'm paralyzed, there's nothing I can do. One time I heard that Bill Hensley went to visit a woman like that, and she was bemoaning the fact that she was still alive, praying to die. She said, there's nothing I can do. And Brother Hensley said, oh yes, there is. You can pray for other people. And it's so true. This destroying judgment as a hailstorm came from the north, from up beyond the Danube River. The extraordinary burning of trees and vegetation is mentioned in the ancient sources as the burning of conquered cities and many stately mansions in Rome itself is mentioned. Regarding the plight of a man by the name of Jovinian, an old man who had been banished to rural poverty, Gibbon, quoting an ancient source, says, his trees, his old contemporary trees, must blaze in the conflagration of the whole country. So that's the first trumpet. Then we go to the second trumpet, Genseric and the Vandals, 422 to 455. A mountain is a kingdom, Jeremiah 51, verses 24 and 25. I am against you, O destroying mountain, obviously referring there to Babylon. The expression, as it were, is used several times here, meaning something like, indicating the symbolic nature of the language. The sea, being the nations or the lands over which the kingdom rules. Jeremiah quoted God speaking to Babylon, I will dry up her sea and make her springs dry. And again in Jeremiah 51, the sea will rise over Babylon. The nations no longer stream into it. The peoples over whom Babylon has ruled will no longer flow into her, but foreign invaders will come and inundate her like a flood. Isaiah 59:19, when the enemy shall come in like a flood, the Spirit shall lift up a standard against him. Revelation identifies Rome with the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, as surrounded by imperial Roman lands. In chapter 13, the seven-headed beast rises up out of the sea. In chapter 17, the great whore sits upon the many waters that are interpreted for us in 17:15 as people, multitudes, and nations, and tongues. Isaiah predicts the demise of an Egyptian empire in terms of the drying up of the sea. The sea turned into blood recalls the Egyptian plague. God hardly seems to regard this community of language as anything other than something that's trying to help us understand what's being said here. The human author was instructed simply to write what he saw, and it's up to us to understand the meaning of that. But the death in the creatures of the sea and the destruction of ships here certainly suggests naval battles. The Goths withdrew from Rome, but in 455, Rome was once more sacked by barbarians, this time by the Vandals from Africa. They had devastated much of Western Europe and Spain en route, occupying Spain in 409. They passed through the Straits of Gibraltar, drove through North Africa, they took Carthage, they sailed for Rome then, across the Mediterranean, and burnt the Roman navy at sea. H.G. Wells, in his Outline of History, says, the Vandals of the south of Spain, under their king Genseric, embarked en masse for North Africa, became masters of Carthage, and then secured the mastery of the sea, and raided, captured, and pillaged the city of Rome. I might just read to you one little section here, again from Gibbon, this time in page 231. The death of Gonderic, he was the Vandal king, served only to forward and animate the bold enterprise. In the room of a prince not conspicuous for any superior powers of mind or body, they acquired his bastard brother, the terrible Genseric, and he's the one on the screen. A name which in the destruction of the Roman Empire has reserved an equal rank with the names of Alaric and Attila. Now this is again a secular historian talking, telling us that we're getting the list right. The ambition of Genseric was without bounds and without scruples, and the warrior could dexterously employ the dark engines of policy to solicit the allies who might be useful to his success, or to scatter among his enemies the seeds of hatred and contention. He goes on, Gibbon's kind of hypnotizing. If I'm not careful, I just go on, and we just can't afford to do that. Long story short here, and I could have gone on to page 299 and 300 there, where it talks about the ships. He cast his eyes toward the sea, and he was going to build a lot of ships. But the long story, in the short synopsis here, is that for 600 years, no ship hostile to the Roman Empire had successfully disputed the mastery of the sea. The Vandals seized Rome. In the 45 years since the Gothic invasion, the pomp and luxury had been in some degree restored. And our word Vandal today is taken from the 2 weeks of the vandalization of Rome by the Vandals. Genseric the Vandal accomplished what Alaric had been prevented by his death from completing. Did you ever wonder what happened to the golden vessels of the Jerusalem temple? It's interesting to consider, isn't it? They were taken by Nebuchadnezzar to Babylon. We know that Belshazzar drank from them. Cyrus sent them back to Jerusalem with Zerubbabel. They were used in Zerubbabel's temple, and they were also used in Herod's temple. They were taken by Titus to Rome in 70 AD, on the Arch of Titus in Rome, in the stone in bas relief are depicted the golden candlestick and the golden table of showbread and other booty taken from the Jewish temple. You can see those in bas-relief in that stone in the Arch of Titus in the city of Rome today. Well, I might read just one note from Gibbon here. Well, I'm glad you're still laughing. Reminds me of when Andy Kaufman stood up and started reading The Great Gatsby. They didn't laugh very long. Their emotions turned. But I was going to just read one little statement here. The holy instruments of the Jewish worship, the gold table and the golden candlestick with seven branches, originally framed according to the particular instructions of God himself, and which were placed in the sanctuary of his temple, had been ostentatiously displayed to the Roman people in the triumph of Titus. They were afterwards deposited in the Temple of Peace, and at the end of 400 years, the spoils of Jerusalem were transferred from Rome to Carthage. Now there's a footnote on the next page that talks about there was a sinking of at least one of the ships in that mass of ships that sailed across there. And I don't know if the golden vessels were on that or not. It's intriguing to me to think that possibly somewhere at the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea, those golden vessels could still be. I don't know the effect of seawater on gold over a long period of time. But it's possible that they sank. More likely they were taken on over to Carthage and then melted down for the metal in them. At any point, however all that may be, this is the point, as far as I know, at which they disappear from history. Obviously the Ark of the Covenant had disappeared in the days of Jeremiah, long before, 1,000 years before. But this is where the rest of those vessels disappear, as far as I know. And I don't really know what really happened to them. However all that may be, Genseric died at Carthage in 477. In verse 10, we see a great star, and we're learning what a star is, an important personage, blazing like a torch. It fell from the sky by a large falling meteorite. The king of Babylon is represented similarly back in Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12, as a falling star. How art thou fallen from heaven, O day star? An illustrious ruler who invades with a fast-moving, destructive army. And that brings us to trumpet number 3, Attila and the Huns, 452 AD. Attila was the king of the Mongol Huns, Scythians who had moved down out of the steppes, mostly in Central Asia, and established themselves in Germany north of the Danube. The Romans had never even heard of these people until 440 AD. The star here is the prominent individual Attila, I believe, from heaven, meaning the course of one who is like a meteor. From this heaven here would be the first heaven, the firmament, the sky as we look up into it, the place where the birds fly, and then the second heaven on above that. Attila's name has become legendary. I'll read you one more thing, and I do mean only one more thing, from The Age of Faith, written by Will Durant. Speaking of Attila, he was a man born into the world to shake the nations, the scourge of all lands, who in some way terrified all mankind by the rumors noised abroad concerning him. He was haughty in his walk, rolling his eyes hither and thither, so the power of his proud spirit appeared in the movement of his body. He was indeed a lover of war, yet restrained in action, mighty in counsel, gracious to suppliants and lenient to those who were once received under his protection. He was short of stature, with a broad chest and a large head. His eyes were small, his beard was thin and sprinkled with gray. He had a flat nose and a swarthy complexion, revealing his origin. Durant is quoting from ancient sources there. According to Gibbon, Attila considered himself to be the receiver of celestial favor and asserted his divine claim to the dominion of the earth. He was viewed superstitiously by his subject princes as a superhuman representative of Mars, the Roman god of war. Gibbon relates that the barbaric princes could not presume to gaze with steady eye on the divine majesty of the king of the Huns. In 441, Attila launched his campaign via the Danube River and its tributaries, and there were hundreds of tributaries of these rivers in that part of the world. Toward the southern, he started heading south into the Roman lands. By 444, Attila was the most powerful man in Europe. I don't know if I should take the time. I probably better not take the time to read one more thing there. Attila was known as the Scourge of God. That's the bottom line on that. We have wormwood mentioned here, Lamentations chapter 3, verses 15 and 19. Wormwood is the symbol of sorrow and calamity by reason of the bitterness of its taste. It's related to the sagebrush plant that we have out in the western part of our country. The oil obtained from the dried leaves and tops of the sagebrush is sometimes called absinthe. Absinthe is a green liquor that's 68% alcohol. The continuous use of it results in mental deterioration or death to the extent that it's now banned in most Western countries. Edgar Allan Poe, as you may know, is famous for drinking absinthe, but we don't know if he really did or not. He's famous for it, whether he actually did it or not. Attila was one of the greatest barbarian rulers who assailed the Roman Empire, attacking various portions of it in both the East and the West. In 452, he invaded Italy and sacked several cities along the many rivers of that area, cutting off headwaters in a very cunning and strategic way. These barbarian assaults toward the imperial city were so extraordinary in their severity that contemporary Christians saw in them the fulfillment of apocalyptic prophecies. Far away in Bethlehem, Jerome lamented when he heard the news from refugees from Rome. He said, "The lamp of the world is extinguished, and it is the whole world which has perished in the ruins of this one city." And down in Africa, Augustine wrote in his greatest work, The City of God, to explain the disaster and to refute the charge that a city which had triumphed over all its enemies as long as it was worshiping the pagan gods had now succumbed at last because its rulers had accepted Christianity. He wrote The City of God to try to refute that charge. Meanwhile, the Western Emperor, Valentinian III, sent three envoys when Attila was right outside the city about to descend upon it. Valentinian III sent three envoys out, and he also sent out the Bishop of Rome. See, Constantine, in removing the capital from Rome, had allowed freer scope to the ambitions of the Roman bishop. So Valentinian III, who's still the emperor, he sends out three envoys, plus the Bishop of Rome, Leo I, to meet with and try to negotiate with Attila. And by the way, after the death of Constantine, there was again appointed a Western emperor, but he didn't rule from Rome. He ruled either from Milan or from Ravenna. So Rome is really coming down in stature from what it used to be. It is said that in their negotiations, the deliverance of Italy was purchased from Attila at an immense ransom. And then Attila died of apoplexy the next year in 453 A.D. His part of the prophecy was done, and so he's gone. They say his body was weighted down and sunk in the Danube River. The glory of Rome had departed. Little now remained there except vain titles and insignia. And we come to the fourth trumpet, Odoacer and the Heruli, 476 A.D. The Heruli were a remnant of the host of Attila. Sun, moon, and stars mean the same thing here as they did in chapter 6, kings and prominent people. The sun refers to the highest ruling authority, moon and stars to lesser powers in the same kingdom. And in chapter 6, we were talking about the whole sun and moon and stars smitten there, but here it's only a third. Here it's only a third, I think, an important point. Odoacer became the first barbarian king of Italy in 476 A.D. The last Western Roman emperor was Romulus Augustulus, and he only reigned less than a year. Odoacer abolished both the name and the office of the Roman emperor in the West, and Romulus Augustulus abdicated from an office that no longer existed after less than a year in that office. Well, I don't know. You're missing a lot by not hearing everything that Gibbon has to say on these. I don't know. I really don't know what to do. Maybe I'll just go to the end. I have now accomplished the laborious narrative of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. The splendid days of Augustus and Trajan were eclipsed by a cloud of ignorance, and the barbarians subverted the laws and palaces of Rome. He's talking about that they're heading into the Dark Ages at this point. The barbarian invasions changed Rome. Rome as a city and the surrounding areas, with their luxury, all the wealth of the world flowing in there and giving them lots of spare time to just deal with all the inventions of the human mind, had become effete to the point of effeminacy. The barbarian invasions engrafted on the effete civilization of the old Romans the healthier moral tone and the stronger physical powers of the Gothic nations. So it was good in that way for the survival of the human family in that area, but it wasn't good for the city of Rome itself. In 476, the Western imperial power was extinguished, and Paul's let or restraint, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 6, was taken away. The bishops of Rome were emancipated. The Roman Senate sent the imperial insignia to Constantinople, saying to the Eastern Emperor Zeno that one emperor is enough for the whole empire. He, of course, lives in the East, in Constantinople. The emperor of the West was formally abolished, and the Roman Senate itself dissolved itself in 550 A.D., Rome saw her glories, star by star, expire. The imperial government at Rome was taken out of the way to make room for the man of sin. While the Caesars ruled there, the bishops of Rome had no chance of becoming monarchs. When the Western Roman Empire fell, the bishops of Rome began to undertake more and more civil responsibilities and to develop more and more into temporal sovereigns. Those things which may have begun as a duty became a source of profit and an object of ambition, and at last they became a divine right. The bishops of Rome were gradually immersed in temporal concerns and the cares of government, and they furtively rose to political power, and the papacy became something that was bought and battled for. It's a strange thing that the Jews expected the Messiah to come when he did come. They were looking for him. They expected him to come, and yet many knew him not when he was come, because they were looking for a temporal monarch with armed power. And in a very similar way, the Christians, God's new Israel, expected the coming of the man of sin. Paul had prophesied this, and yet many knew him not when he came, because they were expecting a barbarous tyrant from the outside. And they made similar assumptions about the Antichrist that the Jews had made about the Christ in the first place. In verse 13, we have the angel in the King James Version, but it really appears to be an eagle, the bird of prey, opposite of the dove of peace. Wheresoever the carcass is, there shall the eagles be gathered together. We've seen the fall of the Western Roman Empire, the third part of the earth, sea, rivers, sun, moon, and stars. And that's all the same third part of the empire, the west as opposed to the east and the southern and central areas. The empire earlier had been divided into three parts, the east and west and the central region in the north of Italy called Illyricum. Main point here is that the book of Revelation is a book of comfort. All that God's people suffer at the hands of others is going to be repaid a thousandfold to those who inflict it. Under Christ, victory is ours if we will just stick with Him. Rome was known as the Eternal City. When Rome was sacked by the Goths in 410, the Romans were in a state of deep shock. They never considered that this could really happen. Many of them saw their downfall as a punishment for abandoning paganism. And that's why Augustine wrote that book about the city of God, which is similar in content to some of what the Hebrew writer has to say in the New Testament. The writer of the Hebrew letter predicted the destruction of Jerusalem, and he said, "Here have we no continuing city, but we seek one to come." Augustine was saying something similar, that we should be concerned with the heavenly city, not any city on this earth. And that's right. The eagle is emblematic of strength and speed and predation. It is shrieking loudly here, "Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth." This bird of prey is proclaiming that the feast is not over, even though the city of Rome has fallen. After all, Rome wasn't even the capital of the empire after Constantine's time. There was increasing paganization in the church. Constantine had erected a supposed statue of Christ in the Forum in Constantinople. The veneration of relics and images of the saints was growing and growing. The transfer of religious customs from paganism into Christian worship were outward signs of the nominalization of Christianity under the state church. Heathenism was revived under a Christian disguise. Christianity was paganized in order to christen paganism. The moral decadence and debauchery of the time was another reason for this divine judgment. We've heard four trumpets, but there are three woes yet to come, three distinct future judgments, and we find them introduced in chapter 9, verse 1, chapter 9, verse 13, and chapter 11, verse 15. The announcement of the three woes shows a marked distinction between the first four trumpets and the three trumpets which follow. The three woes are signaled by the last three trumpets. The more severe judgments are reflected in the more lengthy descriptions that are to come, given in the fifth and sixth trumpets in chapter 9. The text does not identify the third woe, except to say that it is to be announced by the seventh trumpet. When the seventh trumpet sounds, it's followed by an interlude, and then by the little scroll message. And chapters 15 and 16 describe then the seven bowl judgments. These are introduced as the seven last plagues. Last because in them the wrath of God is finished. Chapter 15, verse 1. These bowl judgments are probably the message of the seventh trumpet and the third and last woe. How can it be said that the wrath of God is filled up in them if there are others that are going to come after them or beside them? The recognition of the bowl plagues as the third woe, I think, has important bearing on our understanding of the structure of the entire apocalypse. If we take the bowls as the third woe, then the three woes interwoven with the trumpet series are a completed, in a way that it accords with the first two woes and gives the series the climax that was anticipated when the woes were first announced here. All right, moving on to chapter 9. We're looking here for something after 476 A.D., and I'm going to take the time once again to go ahead and read the first 12 verses of chapter 9. The fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key to the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a furnace, and the sun and air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power as the scorpions of the earth have power. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their forehead. And to them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months. And their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when he striketh a man. And in those days shall men seek death, and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. And the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared into battle, and on their heads were as it were crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men, and they had hair as the hair of women, and their teeth were as the teeth of lions. And they had breastplates, as it were breastplates of iron. And the sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots of many horses running to battle. And they had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months. And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue his name Apollyon. One woe is past, and behold, there come two woes more hereafter. In verse 1, we have a star who is a prominent person. Definition that the Lord himself gave to that in chapter 1, and we've seen in chapter 6 and in chapter 8, holds true. Star is a prominent person, and we're speaking politically here. To me, it seems impossible for this star in chapter 9 to be anybody other than Muhammad. I don't see how you could see it any other way from a historicist point of view. Muhammad was the most important figure in medieval history. He was the prophet of a new and false religion. His fall to heaven is as it appears to man. It's meteoric. He became a servant in the city where his ancestors had ruled. And the key refers to authority. Wherever in prophecy we have key, it refers to authority. The ruler of Mecca, probably something about the key to the Kaaba in Mecca, is involved here. This was a shrine supposedly originally constructed by Abraham and Ishmael, but in pre-Islamic times it had become an idol shrine, housing 360 idol statues, but it became the most sacred shrine in Islam. The bottomless pit is the abyss, the underworld, the abode of the fallen angels, referenced repeatedly in the book of Revelation, notably in chapter 20, which we hope to get to on Friday. The key was given to Muhammad. It may have been given to him by Satan, but we recognize also that the evil at work in the world is, of course, operating within the permissive will of God. The smoke that comes up out of that pit is false doctrine, 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1. All false doctrines originate in hell, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons. Job 38:2. Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? The light of the sun is a fit emblem of the spiritual illumination that comes from the Father of lights, who tells us the truth, and whatever darkens that is false. Muhammad listened to the spirit of fraud. The fumes from the abyss worked in him. He darkened the minds of millions, hundreds of millions, to the Word of God with the false system of religion arising from the pit of hell. The Quran embodies this smoke from the abyss. There was no pretense to Christianity in this, as we'll see later in the apostasy, that this is a separate religion. Of all the revolutions which have had a permanent influence in the history of mankind, none could have been so little anticipated by humanity as the change in the religion of Arabia. When Muhammad was born, it was filled with a bunch of warring, idolatrous tribes. And then it got to the place where the penalty for defecting from Islam to another religion was death, and death without mercy. Muhammad was born in 570 AD in the city of Mecca. His name means highly praised. His father died 2 months before he was born. His mother died when he was 6. He was raised by his grandfather and then by his uncle. Nobody ever seems to have bothered to teach Muhammad to learn to read or write. He was never known to write anything for himself, but illiteracy did not prevent him from composing the most famous book in the Arabic language and from acquiring an understanding of the management of men that is seldom seen. Of his youth, we know almost nothing. Though fables about it fill many volumes, but we just know almost nothing about it. As long as we lack information, we tend to invent it. We do know that Muhammad had some financial savvy. He supervised trading caravans and married his employer, and his first wife, Khadija, was very influential upon him. She was 15 years his senior, and she was huge in the development of his religion, which we hope to take up after lunch, Lord willing. But we need to be back in 10 minutes for class number 3. Thank you very much.